Okay, so the Nephilim.
Ever heard of them?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. If you were to type the Nephilim into a Google search, boy, you'd get some results. Right, and the idea goes something like this. This is the verse we're going to use to base ourselves on. Genesis 6:1-4. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they're mortal, their days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. They were the heroes of old and of renown. And so the myth has grown up that goes something like this. The sons of God were angelic beings, presumably evil angels who had been cast down. The daughters of men were clearly human women. The Nephilim were giants. We'll see where that comes from a little bit later on. And this intermarrying between kind of divine beings and humans upset God so much that it was one of the key factors in bringing about the worldwide flood that destroyed all this wickedness. Okay, so that's the myth. Okay, fine. So let's have a look at this. First of all, we need to actually look quite carefully at the text. And when we do, well, let me give you an example. Okay, it's a completely made-up statement, but let's just read it together. That was, I put it as verse 4, there you go. That was when Manchester City Football Club first began to make multi-million pound transfers when John Major was Prime Minister. They were the cup winners that year, a tremendous achievement. What's John Major got to do with it? Well, that was a very, very important fact to do. Thank you. It sets it on a chronological timeline. So when you unpick this passage over here, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and later as well, when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans and had children by them. What's the link? Time period. Okay. So it isn't necessarily any connection between these Nephilim being the offspring of these sons of God and daughters of humans. It's just coincidentally mentioned. You know, Genesis is a very unevenly edited book. Sometimes you'll get an entire chapter that seems to deal with about 10 minutes of someone's life, and the next minute you get one verse that deals with 1,000 years, more or less. Yeah? This is one of those weird cases where we get the same sort of thing repeated twice, but it doesn't really give us any clues, apart from the clues that are internal to it. Furthermore, if you were to read what a Jewish scholar would say about this, they would point out the following, which is that the structure of this text in the original language, the Hebrew, is ambiguous. Is it the Nephilim at the start of the verse 4, which are the heroes of old, the men of renown, or is it the sons of God who are the heroes of old, men of renown? Apparently, in the Hebrew, either one could work equally well because of the way it's structured. Now, when we turn it into English, it seems to work one way, but apparently it is not necessarily so. These sons of God might have been the men of renown, and you can, you know, that might have been the case. Okay. So let's start figuring out who these different characters and people in this verse are. First of all, the Nephilim. Well, later on, when Israel comes out of slavery in Egypt and they are on the borders of the Promised Land, they send out spies. The spies come back, Numbers 13, they say, all the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, brackets, the descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes and we looked the same to them. Possibly a little bit of exaggeration. I mean, if we're 6 feet tall, 2 meters, well, 1.8 meters tall, and we're like grasshoppers, then these guys will be like 60 feet tall or something. So yeah, okay, bit of exaggeration, but nonetheless, giants who come from the Nephilim. Okay, this is when? Well after the flood. Now straight away you've got a problem with that, because the mythology, remember, is that angels marry human women, and the children they have are these giants. God is angry and destroys the earth. So how many Nephilim were on the ark? Well, none, obviously, because if it's such an abomination that God destroys the earth because of it, he's hardly going to say, oh, come on, the ark. So where did these Nephilim come from after the flood? Or, alternately, you could surmise, well, maybe the angels intermarrying with humans happened again after the flood. But even that doesn't make sense, because if before the flood it upset God enough that he destroyed the earth, what happened when it took place after the flood? Did God just sort of shrug and go, oh, look, they're at it again. Oh, never mind. Well, No, not really. Okay. So I'm going to offer you a much more, I think, logical explanation. Whether you believe in evolution or creation and the story of the flood, you've got the same problem, haven't you? Which is that you start with a pair or a very small number of people, and from those people you end up with all the different races and ethnic characteristics on the planet of Earth at the moment. Okay? So how does that actually happen? Well, here's an interesting case. In 1955, this young lady was born to those parents. Now you can imagine that in 1955 in South Africa, at the height of apartheid, this was a little bit awkward. You see, mum and dad are white Afrikaans. Were long dead by now, I suspect. Their parents were white Afrikaans and proud of it. Their grandparents were white Afrikaans and proud of it. Their great-grandparents were white Afrikaans and proud of it. But the young lady is quite definitely not white Afrikaans. Yeah? Agreed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How can that possibly happen? Well, the answer is that apparently less than 10% of our genetic material actually influences the way we look and our hair colour and our eye colour and so on. The rest just kind of rides along until something... I mean, a really, really obvious example would be the fact that both my wife and I have blue eyes, so we clearly carry the genetic material that makes blue eyes, but our son has brown eyes. So obviously we carry that genetic material too, because we passed it on to our son. So in the same way, what you'd have to realise is that all the genetic material to make tall, fair-skinned, blonde-haired Scandinavians and small, brown-skinned, black-haired, brown-eyed Kalahari Bushmen is carried by the originators of our race. It's just that in some circumstances we've kind of activated some of that DNA, or alternately activated other DNA, perhaps based on environmental factors. And then perhaps once those environmental factors start to come into play, human nature tends to be that people tend to group with other similar people. So a tall, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Scandinavian, given a choice, is statistically more likely to marry another tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Scandinavian, and therefore they pass on that material, that genetic material, to their offspring. Here's another example. That young man is standing with his father. Now, okay, it's slightly an unusual situation, but, nonetheless, he was born with a genetic defect. Genetic defect. Did not limit his growth, and so he grew to his tremendous height. Genetic. So the information there to make very, very tall people grow is in the father's DNA as well. But the father's only ordinary height. You're seeing the picture. So I would suggest to you, therefore, that the giants are Nephilim, we know that from numbers, but they are simply genetic variants within the human race. We already see, even today, enormous variants within the human race in terms of height, build, weight, coloration, etc. Okay? Variations tend to consolidate in populations, partly due to environmental factors and partly, I'm going to call it selective reproduction, in other words, blonde people, on the whole, preferring to mingle and therefore marry with blonde people and whatever else. Okay? Presumably, the same thing must have happened with giants, both before the flood and then after the flood. We know from that same account that the land of Canaan was tremendously fertile, and the one thing you need if you're going to have big people is lots of nutrition. So maybe that was a unique environment in which giants could grow. No need for any supernatural mythology to go on. Okay? So remember, the myth goes like this. Sons of God were angels. An angel plus a woman equals a warrior. Nephilim were warriors. Anyone recognise where I've taken that graphic from? It's Greek mythology, basically. Yeah? Okay, so what people are trying to do with this is they're trying to mix in Greek mythology with the Bible and say, there, you see, it's telling the same story. Alright. Let's talk about reality then, instead of talking about these myths. First of all, any explanation that we're going to go for must arise from a simple reading of the text. There are times when we need to get really, really complicated in interpreting the Bible, but a lot of times it just says what it means and it means what it means, so we just need to go for a simple reading. Secondly, whatever reality we decide upon must be consistent with the themes that run throughout Scripture. So we don't grab this one verse and go, aha, let me build this whole mythology upon this one verse. Rather, we look for some kind of theme that goes throughout. And lastly, whatever we decide upon must be agreed by a majority of scholars. Let's just pause for a moment and think about it. If you're going to write a Bible commentary, what qualifications might you need? Well, probably to start with, you'd need a PhD in theology or in ancient Hebrew or something like that. You'd probably need a considerable number of years of experience working in your field, either in academia, museum curator, something like that. Then, when you felt sufficiently qualified, you'd sit down and write your commentary. But it's got to get published next, hasn't it? So you submit it to a publishing house, who of course hand it over to their editorial committee, who will challenge you on every single point, and you'll have to defend it, and so on and so on. And even if you get past that, you've still got the toughest call yet, which is, if your commentary is ultimately not useful or helpful to people in understanding the Bible and credible in doing so, it's not going to be there in 10 years' time, because nobody will use it. So if you find a commentary that's still there 50 years or 100 years later, you can be reasonably confident. By comparison, the only academic qualification you need to post a video on YouTube is an iPhone. Right? And the last time I checked, an iPhone was not a recognised academic. And that's why you can find endless numbers of videos on YouTube saying that the earth is flat, and the Nephilim were the descendants of the Greek demigods, and the moon is made of blue cheese, which of course we would know if we'd ever sent a manned mission there, really, rather than just staging all in one of the back lots of Hollywood. And the interesting thing about this is, there is actually one more qualification you need to present that pretty glib salesman of your ideas. Have you ever noticed when it comes to salesmen that good products sell themselves? Rubbish products always have slick salesmen. So the more eloquent, the more passionate the presenter on YouTube, the more confident you can be that what they're selling you is rubbish. Go and check against a reliable source. So we're going to do that. We're going to see, well, we're not going to look through all the sources, but I'm just going to tell you that the idea I'm going to present to you is the one that is majority agreed upon by proper stories. Okay. So let's have a look at this then. First of all, a simple. Luke 3:38 gives the following genealogy. Working backwards, the son of Enoch, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. So who are the sons of God? Humans. Okay. Furthermore, Jesus made a very, very interesting point. He says, as many as received him, to them he gave power to become sons of God. Believe on his name. So what about all the people in between? And so we get the idea from this that sons of God are not just all people, but either people who initially were not in rebellion against God, such as Adam initially, or people who have been restored after rebellion because of their belief in Jesus. Okay. Now there are some passages which are a little bit problematic, but actually the reason why this is problematic is interesting, which is why I include it. Job 38:7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Now the King James Version renders that as sons of God, because that's what the original Hebrew says. The NIV says that the sons of God were angels. In other words, that passage says, when the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Why would they do that? Because the King James Version tends to, on the whole, be somewhat slavish in its accuracy, where it is accurate. But the NIV is translated more holistic. And they looked at all the other references to sons of God and went, well, these are human beings. And then they realized that that wouldn't make sense because there were no human beings there when God created the earth. Oh. So they translated it as angels to try and make it more convenient. Now, 2 points. Number one is, accurately it says sons of God. What if sons of God exist on other planets too? What if there are other Adams? What if there are other created beings who have not fallen and are therefore referred to as sons of God, who were there at the creation of our planet? Don't know, but there are ways to explain that passage. Okay, so here's another question to consider. Remember the mythology we're dealing with? Well, let's look at this one, Luke 20. The Sadducees were a group who did not believe in a bodily resurrection. And one day they came to Jesus and set him a trap. And they said, Rabbi, we've got a question for you. Once upon a time there was a man who married, but he died without having any children. Now the law of Moses was set up in such a way that if that happened, the man's brother had to marry the woman. Now that sounds appalling to us, but at the time, because of the way the culture was set up, because a woman had no right to inherit, because a woman needed to be provided for and looked after and protected and so on, and because a woman needed to have a male offspring in order for her family to continue, actually it was an incredibly good law. It just seems very distasteful to us now, but there you go. All right, so the sentence is, so this happened once, it happened twice, it happened three times, it happened seven times. Seven brothers all married the same woman, one after another. None of them managed to actually have children with her. In the resurrection, said the Sadducees, whose wife will she be? Gotcha, Jesus. Answer that one. And Jesus did. He said, the people of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come in the resurrection from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage. And they can no longer die, they live forever, for they are like the angels. Angels don't marry.
They don't reproduce.
Now, here's an interesting point, okay? What kind of God would it be that made a bird who could fly and then said, but you're not allowed to? Or a cheetah that could run and then said, you're banned? So what kind of God would it be that would create angels with the facility, physical facility, to marry, with the desire to marry, with the hormonal drive to marry, and then said, no, you're not allowed to? So I think it's safe to conclude from this that angels don't have the physical facility to marry, or the drive, or the desire, or the hormones, etc., to marry. So the idea that these angels would come down from heaven, see human women and go, wow, look at that, gonna marry one of those, just doesn't make any sense at all, okay? So again, from a plain reading of the text, we can draw some conclusions. Adam was the first son of God. Born-again Christians are sons of God. Angels don't marry. Therefore, the sons, and of course the daughters of God, are simply those who, A, have not rebelled against God, or those who have been restored after the rebellion. Now, this distinction is really important when we go back to that passage and look at what it means. The sons of God are those who have not rebelled against God. Okay. Let's move on. Sometimes, in order to understand the end of a book, we'll have needed to read the beginning. That makes sense. But sometimes, in order to understand the beginning of a book, you need to read the end. Because only when you've got to the end of the book do you understand why the author set up the beginning of the book the way that they did. Okay? The same is true of the Bible. For example, in Genesis, we have God, the serpent, or the dragon, two superpowers, two opponents. You have the sons and daughters of God and the sons and daughters of man, distinct groups. But then when you look at Revelation, if we can get to Revelation, there you go. What have you got in Revelation? You've got God, and you've got a dragon. Same two powers going at one another, competing. Okay? And you've also got two groups of people, one of whom has received the seal of God, received the mark of the beast. The parallels are pretty obvious, aren't they? Yes? Okay. What is also pretty concerning is this idea. Revelation 19:4, another voice from heaven say, come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, will not receive of her plagues. In other words, the idea of separation. What's really sobering about that passage to me is this. If God has to call from heaven his people to come out of Babylon, where are his people at that point? In Babylon. So the sobering message, just sort of as an aside, is that prior to the final destruction of the earth and the return of Christ, God's people will be in Babylon. Because otherwise he wouldn't need to call them to come out of them. Makes sense, doesn't it? Alright, here's a thought. Prior to the flood, the sons of God were with the daughters of man. And it upset God so much it destroyed the earth. Can you see the parallel? In Revelation, just prior to the destruction of the earth, God makes one final attempt to separate people. Prior to the flood, the problem was that two separate groups of people began to become one. So let's talk a little bit about this idea of separation as we go through. Abraham, for example, was to come out. Israel was to be a separate nation. Of course, when we get to the New Testament, we find exactly the same thing. You were a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. God's special possession, you may declare the praise, called you out of darkness and full light. In other words, this idea is not just there in Genesis, sons of God, sons of man, not just there in Revelation, seal of God, mark of the beast. It's throughout Scripture. Consistently, God calls his people to be separate. Well, let's have a think about where this goes wrong then. You remember the story of Balaam, of course. Numbers 25, we'll look up later. When the king of Moab saw this enormous group of people arriving on the borders of his land, he naturally panicked, realised he couldn't fight them, and so he decided to use sorcery and witchcraft, and he called on this prophet and said, come and curse these people. Well, you remember the story of the donkey and the angel and the seven sacrifices. No, 21, wasn't it? Seven and three times or something. Anyway, whatever. The point was, Balaam was unable to curse God's people. Instead, he actually offered a messianic prophecy, which must have upset the king somewhat. So finally, in a desperate attempt to A, solve the king's problem and get rid of God's people, and B, earn the money he'd been promised, Balaam came up with an idea. He said, send on the dancing girls. Send in the pretty girls. And sure enough, the men of Israel began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women who invited them to the houses of their gods. In other words, the sons of God looked at the daughters of men and saw that they were well-fit mate to get naughty with them. And the result was that the Lord's anger burned against them. Are you seeing this consistent pattern coming through now? Okay. Now then, we need to answer a question, because the Bible seems to suggest that this is about marriage. It's just about marriage. Certainly in Genesis it was about marriage. In that case it was about sexual immorality. And this does seem to be. Genesis 24, for example, Abraham said, I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, but go to my country and among my own relatives. Why? Because his own relatives were the people of God, and Canaanites were the sons and daughters of man, if you will. We pick up exactly the same passage here in Deuteronomy 7. Do not intermarry with the people around you. Don't give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for yours. God is serious about this idea being separate. Go forward, let's have a look at two more. Ezra. Okay, this is after the return from Babylon. Therefore, do not give your daughters in marriage to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons. Pretty unequivocal, isn't it? 2 Corinthians, do not be yoked together with believers, for what do righteousness and goodness have in common, or what fellowship can light have with darkness? These seem like really, really harsh instructions, unless you set them in the context of this idea that from Genesis to Revelation there are two groups. And the two groups are supposed to remain separate. Simple as that. Okay. But it's not just about marriage. It's not just about marriage. We all know the story of Lot, I think, in Genesis. We know the bit about how God saw the wickedness of Sodom. And as the story unfolds, we see just how the wicked this place had actually become. And so God decided to do it. But he sent angels ahead to warn them. As you read the story, you discover that these two men, these two angels, showed up in the town centre, decided to spend the night in the city square, and Lot, who knew perfectly well what kind of place he was living in, said, oh boy, you don't want to go doing that. You can't spend the night in the square. Something horrible will happen to you. And he was right, because no sooner had he taken them back as guests to his own house than the scripture tells us the entire male population of the place showed up outside his door, demanding that he bring the men out for a good dose of gang rape. Great place to live, right? Now the angels then performed a miracle and struck all this rioting crowd blind. And right after performing a miracle of that magnitude, they said, now listen to us. Well, I'd take them seriously at that point, wouldn't you? You know, you see a miracle like that, and then the angel says, and by the way, you need to leave because God's about to destroy this place. Wow, you'd take them seriously, wouldn't you? So Lot went off to his son-in-laws, and he said, come on guys, we've got to get out of here. But they wouldn't listen to him. They were quite happy where they were. And what happens as the story progresses is that we find there are three groups of people that come out of this. First of all, the sons-in-law. They're not interested in leaving. I can imagine the conversation. Are you too worried that we weren't a part of that nastiness earlier? We know that kind of thing goes on, but we're not involved with it. Well, no, it's not us. You know, we're better than that, right? So we'll stay here. It's not that bad. We're quite comfortable where we are. And of course, this is the response that a lot of people give to the call, come out of her, my people. Same as Lot's sons-in-law did when the angel said, come out of Sodom. Then there was Lot's wife. You know the story. In the morning, the angels finally grabbed Lot and his wife and the two daughters and dragged them out of town. And when they got clear of the city, they said, right, now run and don't look back. Just get away from here quickly. And of course, Lot's wife did look back. And presumably it was more than just a glance over her shoulder. Presumably she lagged behind the rest of the group, and she was affected by whatever destroyed the city. Because the truth of it was, although she had physically left, her heart was still back there. She wrote about night. She was still thinking about the dinner party she was going to throw for the following day. Whatever else it was, the luxuries, the puts, the entertainments, and she lost her life as a result. But the third group is, in a way, far more worrying. You see, Lot and his daughters did get out of Sodom. They did escape. They did go and live near a little town not very far away. But some time passed, and the daughters decided that they needed to have children, and they had a suitable husband around. So they decided their best course of action was to get their father drunk and sleep with him. Yeah, that's pretty much the reaction any normal person would have to that. You see, the truth of the matter is, you can take the girl out of Sodom, but it's harder to take Sodom out of the girl, or the boy. We think of incest these days, and you know, even in our incredibly permissive society, we still pull faces at the idea of incest, don't we? We still make jokes about it, we still scoff at rural communities where it may or may not go on, but these guys have no problems with it. First thing that came to mind was not, hey dad, take us somewhere else where we can find husbands. It was, hey dad, let's get you drunk and sleep. And so the sad part is, some people, even those that come out of, or even those that separate themselves, it takes a long time to really change the thinking, really change the heart, really change what drives the behaviour. Okay. So this call, come out of her, my people, we know that this is an end. We know that this is something that happens as Earth draws to the close of its history. I'm not talking geographically, obviously. I'm talking spiritually. I'm talking in terms of our behaviour. We enjoy the activities we pursue, the hobbies we engage in, the places we invest our money. How separate are we from the world, from Sodom, from Babylon? Are we prepared to genuinely be? Or are we in danger of doing what the sons of God? They looked at the daughters of men. They were beautiful. In other words, there was something desirable about this other lifestyle. So instead of remaining separate, they crossed that divide. Marriage might be one way, might be one way. But there are many other ways in which people can cross the divide. I mentioned some already. What is it? And are we actually ready to be separate? So, some sobering thoughts, not something we want to perhaps discuss publicly, but something which I hope can challenge in our spiritual life. Thank you.